came about because there was a bit of serendipity. The two clubs, Brandeis Kabad and the Brandeis Humanists, happened to be assigned table spots next to each other at the club fair. Nobody knew it was coming up to either table, so they had to go up to each other. Why not? But obviously, they both had something to say to the Brandeis community, and I'm very happy about the turnout. I'm teaching a course on consciousness and the brain and the mind, and in the first paper assignment, I told the students at the beginning, don't start with a big generalization like consciousness is one of the hardest problems, or people have wondered for thousands of years about the nature of the mind. So I'm not going to start with any big generalizations about the issue of the existence of God. You all know it's an important one. And I'll just get right down to business. So the format, participants in our debate from the Humanist Society, Brandeis Humanist rather, Max Lewis on your far left, a religious studies major, and Jonah Cohen, a psychology and philosophy major. And on my right, Alexander Lyax, who is a graduate student in neuroscience, and Rabbi Perez Payne of the Brandeis, of the Chabad House at Brandeis. So the format will be as follows. The Chabad participants will give 10 to 15 minute presentations of their positions, determined by a flip of the coin that they go first, followed by 10 to 15 minute presentations by the humanists. Then there'll be 30 minutes spent responding to questions formulated by, at the last minute by me, the moderator. There'll be short closing statements from Chabad and then from the humanists, and then the topic will be thrown open to the audience for further discussion. So without any further ado, I invite our representative from the Chabad, Brandeis Chabad, to take the floor.
I want to begin by thanking Professor Steinbeck for moderating this event. Thanking all of you for coming out here and participating in this event, and especially thanking Max and Jonah for agreeing to this event and for helping organize it. A first for an event of this type, and the turnout reflects that. The question that we're discussing here is, does God exist? And the first thing we need to begin with is with definitions. And the first definition we need to address is existence. How are we to define existence? And we begin with the first and the simplest by observing with our senses. This table over here exists because I see it, I touch it, if I take a bite out of it, I might even taste it. Our senses, which are tangible, tell us that something exists. It's pretty basic in elementary. My little kids, 3 and 7, understand that and know that. But then we get to a more complex definition of existence. And that's something that I might not necessarily have myself sensed, but somebody else sensed it. And that other person who sensed it reported it to me, told me about that. And if that person has credibility, well then for me that thing exists. Literary evidence, our entire basis for history, is based on this idea of reportage. Witnesses in a court, the judicial system is based very strongly on that. And so does journalism, as long as they're biased, is based on that as well. And we consider that as a proof of existence. As long as somebody who has sensed it, encountered it, reports it in a credible manner. And the third form definition for proof of existence, for something for us to exist, is when we don't necessarily sense a particular thing, but we sense its effect. And from its effect, we conclude that the cause exists. And the cause is sometimes something we can sense. We can sense, but very often than not, it's only a theory. It's this theory that we theorize is what brought about this particular effect. Science is based very much on this idea of definition of existence. For instance, pick up this recorder and let go of it and drop down to the ground. Now, if I'd ask anybody here, why did that happen? Clearly, you know, some forces of gravity pulled it down. So the effect is the droppage of the recorder, but the cause is what we do not necessarily see, but we theorize based on science and Einstein's definition in the curvature of space, that forces of gravity is what pulls down. But nobody here has seen or sensed, and nobody has ever sensed or seen, this curvature in space as Einstein defined it. But nonetheless, we consider that to be an existence that exists because of our observation of cause, and that leads us to that considered effect, and that effect does, we do consider that effect to exist. Now, by these three definitions of proof of existence, or that something exists, is something that we apply in our day-to-day life, all around us, we should use that same definition when we take that and apply it to God. Does God exist? And use the same definition of existence, whether through observation of cause, an application or theory, or through credible reportage. Otherwise, there's no gravity, and George Washington and the Tooth Fairy led the revolution.
So, I'd like to present you with examples of along the lines of Paris's definitions of proof. And I just want to warn you that these are merely bullet points, and each one of them deserves a whole discussion on its own. So, first one is cause and effect. We know that everything that surrounds us happens as a cause and effect. Every effect has a cause. And I don't mean just in historical sense, that you know, I'm here in this place and time and space because something must have happened thousands of years ago, or maybe multiple causes. I also mean in immediate effect. Everything has its properties, everything has its existence, and everything that is an emergent property of something else below it, it is an effect of some cause. This table is solid. Why is it solid? Because there's molecular lattice which supports it, which gives it the property of solidity. Well, why do molecules have those properties? Because they consist of specific atoms, which have their properties. And atoms consist of protons, and neutrons, and electrons, each having their own properties. Those consist of quarks, and those are supposedly consisting of vibrating strings, and so on. But there has to be the first cause for all this to be supported. Otherwise, it becomes like a joke when a geologist was standing, like I am here, in front of you, and was saying that the Earth consists of tectonic plates which are moving, and there was a woman in the audience who said, yeah, but everybody knows that Earth is sitting on a giant turtle. And he decided to play along with her and said, well, what is the turtle sitting on? On another turtle? What is that sitting on? On another turtle? What is the first turtle sitting on? Ah, young man, you ain't gonna fool me. It's turtles all the way down. So, we don't... We must ask the question, where is the source of all the properties that we see in this world? And we can deduce, using logic, that there must be a source which by itself cannot have properties, which must be simple, which must be singular, which must not be bound by space and time, and which must be the cause of all existence. Not through randomness, because randomness entails something existing outside of the cause, leading to random effect. The cause must lie completely within. That's first line of evidence. The second one is famous argument from design. We see the world around ourselves in a complex. And we know from our experience that things which are complex tend to be designed by humans. We know that about some things. We can extrapolate that to the world and say that the design that we see in the world must also be a result of some organizing force, some intelligence. Einstein once said that if you look at the universe, it seems like you go into a library like this, and you see a lot of books sitting on shelves. And they seemingly, first they seem to be organized in some random order. But then when you look at it, you see that they are organized in some sort of hierarchy, and hierarchy above that, and hierarchy above that. And there must be some organized force which put them all together. And third, and the most powerful argument for me personally is the argument of reportage, evidence. The first two arguments do not lead to Jewish God. They lead to a source of the universe. They don't lead necessarily to God who gave Jews laws and told us to wear little strings on the edges of our clothes. What leads to God is reportage, is a tradition of information passed down the generation that there was a mass revelation at Mount Sinai in which Jews saw, in which Jews received revelation from God. Now, when one person tells me he's seen UFO, he may be right, but I have no reason to believe him. Maybe, you know, he was crazy, maybe he had a hallucination. If two people see it, if three people see it, a little bit more evidence, but still not so sure. If a lot, so the more people see it, and this is the same idea as in the court of law or in any other idea, the more people see something, the more credulity this receives. Now you may say, yeah, but the Bible says that Jews received and saw God at Mount Sinai. But the Bible was written by people. The Bible was written by people. They said that the whole nation saw God. How do you know that this actually happened? How do you know that somebody did not invent this myth? Well, this idea, this story must have appeared from somewhere. And there are two possibilities. One possibility is that it was falsified. It was created as a myth, and then people were convinced it's true. The second possibility is that it actually happened. Now, I want to briefly present an argument that such story as mass revelation of anything, any mass evidence, cannot be falsified. You cannot be convinced that your ancestors saw God if that already had not happened. Because such an event as seeing God does not pass out of memory of a nation. And therefore, by the time when I come to you, let's say, by the way, your ancestors saw God. But if that already happened, then you must already have information about it. And expect to already know about it. And if you don't, then you will not believe me. I can convince you that last year I've been to Alaska. How can I convince you? Because you have no reason to disbelieve me. Why should you disbelieve me? Are you my Siamese twin? Are you following me everywhere? You weren't there, so what? But if I tell you that all of you together last year have been to Alaska, you're not going to believe me. Why? Because if you had been to Alaska, you must already have memory. Yeah, but you forgot. All of us here took a trip to Alaska last year, just forgot about it. Well, that's just unlikely that all of us would forget at the same time about the trip to Alaska. Therefore, you're not going to believe me because you would already expect to have this knowledge necessary. And therefore, it would not be necessary for me to convince you. Therefore, I find it more probable to believe that this event already happened, even though it has a supernatural element in it, revelation of God. But within the realm of logic, it is more logical to assume that this supernatural event happened than to assume that such a story was invented. And if you say, yeah, but maybe a dictator came and convinced people all at once, well, this is just a hypothesis. You can imagine it, but in the field of logic and science, you have to use evidence to support your hypothesis. To find how likely something is to occur, you can do two things. You can make an experiment, which unfortunately we cannot make experiments with societies, although our government sometimes thinks otherwise. And second, we can just use observations. We can look at all the societies and all the religions and see how often a myth of mass revelation occurs. I won't say we travel in time, it occurs only once. It shows you how probable it is to invent such a story from scratch. Thank you.
I want to conclude with one more point, and that is the relevance of what Alice brought out, this idea of God revelation basically means a engaged God and a responsive God, a God who cares what goes on and demands of his creation. And that leads us to one of the issues of the relevance of God regarding the idea of morality. Now, to claim that only those that believe in God or are aware of God or have heard of God, our moral people, is preposterous. Many people who don't believe God, never heard of God, do good things and do many good things. But the question is, the theory, the idea behind morality, what is that based on? What drives it? Now, there is more reason, in a sense, for the individual to be immoral than to be moral, to look out for themselves, look out for their personal comfort and their personal survival, then not. However, as society at large, and I'm here presenting the non-God argument, as a society at large, we will all personally benefit if we're all moral. If you behave immoral to others, somebody will do that back to you, and it doesn't benefit you in the long run. Now, this is basically based on social calculation of your overall benefit. And the key is personal benefit based on calculation. From the God perspective, however, the reason why you should behave justly and rightly is because you are required to. It's your responsibility to conduct morally because God told you so. And it's a sense, it's an absolute responsibility that you have. And the key is not calculation or self-benefit, but the key is moral response, is responsible, personal responsibility, not social benefit. What's the difference? Well, the difference is big. When you're by yourself alone, or when you make the calculation that for you personally, it's more beneficial in the present to behave immorally, to steal something, to harm somebody, and it won't make a big difference in the entire society if right now you go do something inappropriate. Well, in such a case, the likelihood of you behaving morally is very small because you've made the calculation a little different than it is at large. However, when you're alone, or when there's a danger posed to you by certain, you know, discomfort, or perhaps even endangers you, you cannot justify behaving immorally, doing something inappropriate, stealing or something, because there is no calculation involved in why you should behave morally. It's just a responsibility that you have to your Creator. Thank you.
Just so you guys know, there's more seats for a minute. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for being here today. Special thanks to Eric, Max, and thanks for Sarah. I was going to take a wee bit to bring the dialogue to this committee. This course is of central nature, and I'm extremely optimistic and happy to see that I'm joining this endeavor by so many. Conversation is a remarkably powerful tool. It is the bedrock of the most important areas of our discourse, from government and politics to science and academia to civility. And when it comes to religion and faith, such conversation is quite obviously absent. It is taboo to critique the institution of religion. We can speak about everything that is important in our lives, from economic philosophies to political parties to ethical theory, with no expectation of respect and not caring about offending someone else. This is what conversation is at its core. But when one wishes to talk about why the neighbor shouldn't move the light switch on Saturday, one is met with intense irritation. It is simply not permissible, because of the unwarranted respect we give to faith, to hold a sincere, furious conversation about the origins of the universe. When it comes to faith, conversation is fundamentally a non-starter, and this needs to change. We wouldn't respect a doctor who believes he has cured HIV/AIDS, but won't tell you why or how or begin to have his data challenged. When a brilliant moral philosopher registers as a conscientious objector, he's met by a harsh set of questioning by a drafter. Meanwhile, a 17-year-old Quaker without a high school education meets no such opposition. We can laugh at a belief in Santa Claus or Zeus, but such practice is sentenced by death in Islam. Some people's beliefs are immune to skeptical inquiry and conversation. There's nothing that an unknown Christian, Jew, or Muslim can say to one another that allows them to converge upon a common point. They believe what they believe in no matter what the other says. And this is the very essence of dogmatism. And it's precisely what conversation fights against. It seems that something so important, an idea that affects so many, should be open to dialogue. Religion and faith deserve no more respect than any political or economic philosophy. It is okay to defend people. We're all offended by female circumcision, by genocide, by poverty, and by world hunger. It is okay to be offended. We're trying not to offend someone. It's not respect. In fact, it's the antithesis of respect. It's indifference. If we can hold a truly honest conversation about faith and all its implications, it doesn't seem that it can withstand the power of conversation. We live in a world of uncertainty, and for those who claim certainty, should in theory have no issue explaining to those who admit they simply do not know. Opening a conversation will allow people to see that religions in our world make genuinely incompatible claims. As such, we are Muslims pitted against Christians pitted against Jews, and this is exceedingly dangerous. We need to be identified as people first, and this starts with eliminating childhood indoctrination. Isn't it an astonishing coincidence that they're all born of the same religion as our parents, and moreover, it's always the right one? If we were born in ancient Greece, we'd all be worshipping Zeus and Poseidon. If we were brought up with Vikings, we'd be Odin and Thor. These are all gods that were prayed to, sacrificed to, and parents told their children of fact. No matter how sincere they were at the time, they were deluded, and most of us, hopefully, can convert upon this point. You're all presumably atheists with respect to Zeus and Poseidon. Some of us, myself included, just go one god further. Living in childhood indoctrination begins when we stop labeling children with the religion of parents. We don't talk about an atheist child or a Gnostic child or a humanist child. We don't talk about a communist child, a libertarian child, or a socialist child. But we do talk about a Jewish child, a Christian child, or a Muslim child. No. These are children of Jewish parents, of Muslim parents, and of Christian parents. One is not a faith to give meaning to one's life. A child can be a fully happy individual and accomplish one at that, without such labels. One can get the richest experience, immersing oneself in the awe-inspiring knowledge deep that is our universe. The very fact that miracles do not exist, that the seven continents make sense, that things can be explained rationally, is shudderingly beautiful and elegant. If one goes through the world thinking that it's okay to believe things without sufficient evidence, one is missing so much. One can be deeply religious, like Einstein Spinoza, and may not make an appeal to the supernatural. Jules Verne, a French writer and founder of modern-day science fiction, once wrote that reality provides us with facts so romantic that imagination itself could add nothing to them. Meaning can be found here, and now, and today, without making an appeal to divine hope or divine being. Ethics and spirituality do not require faith. One can achieve utter absorption in the mystery of the present moment without believing anything in insufficient evidence. Again, I'd like to thank all of you for being here today, and I'm very eager to immerse myself along with all of you on this very necessary conversation.
You should be a Mormon today, and I'll tell you why. No, of course there's a reason behind it.
and these reasons to be picked apart. Furthermore, these are not totally unnecessary. Millions of people live happy lives without God, moral lives without God. Joan and I are two of them. I believe there's probably millions of them, if not tens of millions of them. I would like to just issue a challenge that Christopher Hitchens has offered to theists, and it's pretty simple. It's a two-part challenge. The first part is name one ethical statement made or one ethical action performed by a believer that could not have been uttered or done by a non-believer. And the second part of this is name a wicked statement made or an evil action performed solely based on religious faith. Another reason I don't believe in God is that there's no coherent definition of God. So we talked about the definition of existence, and that's all well and good. We have to talk about the existence of the definition of God. Is he omniscient? Is he omnipotent? Is he omnibenevolent? Well, logically, he can't be all three. And I'll give you an example that Dan Barker gives often. If all of you knew, or any of you knew, what was going to happen on September 11th, and you had the power to stop it, would you have stopped it? Well, if God is omniscient, he knew what was going to happen. If he's omnipotent, he could have stopped it, but he didn't. So he's not omnibenevolent. He's not an all-good God. He lets evil happen. So you can't hold on to that definition anymore. Furthermore, free will cannot account for these moral evils, because these are results of human nature. And who designed human nature if God exists? God. Therefore, he is to blame. If God is omniscient, that he would have known of all the horrible moral evils that occur, and yet he did nothing to stop them. Surely God could have done a better job than this. I mean, I think me and Jonathan have done a better job than this. So clearly, some of these examples cannot be proved by saying, okay, you know, God gave you free will. This doesn't work. God cannot be all merciful and all just in the same being. Because if God was all merciful, I mean, it's a lovely thought to have. If he was all merciful, it would be wonderful. Because Jonah and I wouldn't have to worry anymore. But if he was all merciful, then right now, you can just envision this. There's a child rapist playing chess with Mother Teresa right now. Because he's all merciful. He does everything. You can do anything you want, and it's okay. Because he has all the mercy in the world for you. Therefore, he's not all just. So you have to really choose what kind of God you want to believe in. Again, if he's omniscient, then he knows in advance exactly what he's going to do. Because an omniscient being has to have knowledge of everything. So he's not even free. We're talking about a being that's as bound as you and I. He knows exactly what he's going to do, so he can't really have free will. Furthermore, if he knows the sequence of events, if he knows everything, and he knows exactly what's going to happen in 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 20 years, 1,000 years, then there's no free will. There's a set sequence of events that's going to happen, so no matter what we do, it's going to happen. There's no free will. Finally, I'll just end with this. I mean, God is expected to be perfect, and why not? Who would rather worship an imperfect being to a perfect being? I would love to worship a perfect being. But this is what you have to deal with a perfect being. Anything you say, do, think, or feel is not going to affect this God at all. You can love him all you want, you can hate him all you want, he's not going to change. It's a perfect being in a perfect state, and that state cannot change. So when you ask him for a prayer, don't expect it to be answered. Because he's not going to change. And that's something you have to live with. You have to live with. If you want to believe in God, you have to believe in a God that doesn't care about you. That doesn't think about you. You can pray to him all you want, but it's not going to make an ounce of difference. And this to me does not sound like the God of ethical monotheism. They want it to be, but logically it cannot stand. And we'll get into this some more, but they spoke about the Bible a little bit. And although I'm sure I'm not as well versed as either Paris or Alex in this, I can tell you from my brief experience that the Bible is one of the most discredited books of all time. I mean, it's full of logical contradictions. We know who wrote the Bible, 5, 6, 7, maybe 10 men. We don't have their names, but they have titles. You can go into the library and read a book called Who Wrote the Bible by Richard Elliot Freeman. And he lays out the whole argument. It's very, very simple. And we can get into more specific details again, but I mean, you can just look at the God. This God was so jealous that he called himself jealousy. He had jealous of other gods. If other gods didn't exist, why is he getting jealous? Why is he so worked out? This sounds like a human being to me. I mean, I get jealous when my girlfriend looks at another guy. I mean, that's a human emotion. Why is God jealous? Why is he so insecure? You know, this doesn't happen to scientists. You don't go into a lab, and you see scientists holding hands, and they're saying, "Oh, I believe in gravity. Gravity is real." What goes up, 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 must come down. This stems from clear insecurity. An insecurity that's displayed in the God of the Old Testament. So I'll leave you with that. Just think about it. I mean, what is God? What qualities does he have? Does he have any qualities? Can we know them? Is it really worth your effort to spend every Saturday or every Sunday or Friday night praying to him? Couldn't you be somewhere else helping people if they're starving or have diseases? Couldn't you be spending your time more productively? I think so. Thank you.
Both sides seem very certain of their position, very different from most people who seem plagued by doubts no matter what position they take. So I'd like each side to say what they think is the strongest point that the other side is able to raise against their position.
One of the points that Max has raised in God's talk is the definition of God. And attacking it from many, many, many points, many directions. And I will certainly agree that the point of this get-together was the existence of God. But beyond that, in the definition of God, I will agree that it is a complex topic that needs to be not just believed in, as Jonah pointed out, but also understood, and understood intellectually. And that is a topic that requires a lot of study, a lot of insight, a lot of thought, a lot of critical thought. But yes, it's not as simplistic and clear that that is as obvious as the table standing and sitting here in front of us. And I add one more point, that is something that I engage in a lot. Spend a lot of time trying to understand and from all different perspectives, amongst them the question is the issue that Max raises, because they're very clear and elementary.
So first, I think we've done something that we're not really certain. We know exactly what would convince us. Otherwise, I mean, if the Bible pointed to some germ or disease or some future happenings, it would only take us a couple seconds if Jesus came down from the clouds to believe that there was a God. In terms of what we believe is probably the most convincing, it's what Alice mentioned in terms of that religion provides community and something that human beings can surround themselves with. And that certainly, every human being is fallible and they need things that allow them to converge and often offer comfort. But I think the utility and the truth argument are entirely separate entities.
I can't say I'm fully satisfied. This is the third position that I get to. So here's a question about faith. Assuming that for most people, their religious life is in some sense grounded on faith as opposed to certainty. We can have faith in our children. Not you, I'm talking about this side. That despite appearances, they'll get their lives in order. We can have faith in ourselves, in my own case, that despite the evidence of past resolutions, I will finally begin exercising, and so on. So my question is, apart from argument, logic, proof, evidence, how do you understand this notion of faith, and what should its role be in determining our theological beliefs and religious life? I think the first shot.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I don't think any faith, in not in the sense of faith in somebody you love or faith in a child, there's nothing wrong with that. But faith in something that you would devote your life to, that offers you, and I know you don't use evidence or logic, but this is how we think, by our best time, maybe Jordan and I. But I can't really answer the question about using logic. I can't have faith in something unless I see some evidence for it. I don't need faith in a supernatural father figure. I think faith is perfectly fine within human relationships, where there is evidence, where you have faith in a husband and wife that they'll be faithful to you, and with a lot of faith. And that's proven by them not cheating on you. And that's, from years of being together, and then there's proof there. I don't think that something should be moved on from sufficient evidence. And I'm not saying it's not okay, I'm just saying don't expect anybody else to believe you. And don't expect that to be a rule for society. And don't expect that to convince people. If it's good for you, that's fine. But then you should keep it to yourself. You might want to share it if you think it's useful, but if people ignore you, you know why they're ignoring you.
I don't think Max and I would argue for a purely rational world. I don't think it exists. I don't think that love can be explained by reason. I don't think it's in opposition to reason, but I don't think it can be explained by reason. Does not mean if you look at a human's discomfort with with reason and how there's faith on the very core of it, or Gödel's discomfort with mathematics and his Euclidean theorem, this doesn't give Mormonism any more plausibility. We can live in a purely rational world that's filled with emotion that can't be explained by reason, but the claims of emotion are not in opposition to reason. There's two different levels of faith here. There's the level of faith in terms of human relationships and human emotion and human experience, and then there's extraordinary claims of faith that one can make in any dimension. In terms of all the other gods, there's a distinction between faith that in our everyday lives, and there's a distinction between supernatural faith. And to say that they're synonymous is a mistake, I believe.
First, as a neuroscientist, I would like to disagree that love cannot be explained, but faith can be. But seriously, I agree. Faith is evil. Nobody should use faith. Well, you can use reason, and people should use reason. There is no reason why you should use faith. You should not believe in something blindly or from emotion. And unfortunately, people do use faith a lot of times, and a lot of people think things have been done because of faith. I think our current market is collapsing because of faith and real things. And in general, a lot of bad things happen because of faith. So you need reason, and I agree with everything that John and I said about needing reason and rationality to believe in something, 100%. Where faith does come in Judaism, that I should make a parenthetical disclaimer that we're not here arguing on behalf of religion in general and monotheism in general. We're arguing here on behalf of Judaism. Where faith comes in Judaism, and then, when other religions that derive from Judaism use for faith, they may mean something else. But when faith comes into Judaism, it's humility about your own intellectual abilities to understand something that is beyond you. And if sciences of 20th century has taught us anything, it's humility. In order to know that in a double slit experiment, an electron flies through both slits, you need reason, you need logic, you need evidence. But from my everyday experience, it's just nonsense. I mean, I cannot imagine it happening. I know from evidence that, yeah, it happens, but I cannot imagine. The idea that the faster this pen flies, the shorter it becomes. It's I know it by reason. It's by the way, specialty of relativity by Einstein. But it just boggles my mind. Just intuitively,
it's wrong. But physics and science in general teaches us that there will be areas which we cannot penetrate. You cannot see inside a black hole by definition, but you can know where a black hole is in space by something that surrounds it. For example, if a big star is being sucked into big nothing, the big darkness, you probably know that there's a black hole there. The same thing is about God. I believe, according to evidence that we presented and other lines of evidence, you can deduce about God. But there will be aspects. There will be aspects of about God, which by definition, as a result of him being in a different reality, as a result of him being the first cause, will mean that we cannot we cannot intuitively and logically and intellectually understand those things. Just like I cannot intuitively understand a lot of things in modern science. But I know logically and rationally based on proof that they are true. I know I look at mathematical formulas and I go, yeah, that's true. But what do they mean? I intuitively don't understand. So this is what faith means. Faith means, well, I see a logical contradiction which I don't understand. And therefore, it must be all not true. And faith is ability to understand that this logical contradiction is there because this something may not necessarily be a logic. But where you got to that step, how you got to that door through which you enter and then use faith is through logic. I agree with that.
So, I agree with most of what you said, Alice. I'm just curious how you go from saying that you have the reason to, and believe you can deduce, making the affirmative claim of what it is. So, how do you, I can intuitively believe that, in terms of what Bertrand Russell said, that there's no flying teapot going around the solar system right now. And that's intuitive. But how can you make the affirmative claim that this is what it is, and tell me what it is? And, I make the affirmative claim of the exact same thing, but say that there must be a first cause and there must be this, but just call it X. Why does it have to be the Judeo Christian God?
So there are two lines of two ways to answer this. First of all, when we define the first cause, that definition places some limitations on what first cause cannot be. First cause cannot consist of parts, for example. First cause cannot have properties. First cause must dual, etc. So that already gives us some information about the first cause in terms of negative point of what it cannot be. But then, as I said, the most powerful source of our information about God is actual personal revelation, which happened in which God has revealed certain things. I mean, certain abstract ideas we can deduce by logic and through theology about the first cause, etc., which are not very many things, many positive things, most things which God cannot be by being a first cause. But all the other information about God that we see in the Bible and in Jewish tradition, which accompanies Bible, and with mystical explanation of what exactly do all those child-looking things about God getting angry, what exactly do they mean? All those things we get as a tradition, we get as a package of information from God. I forgot to address another thing that I said about personal faith. And you can have faith in personal relationship. You can have faith about your girlfriend not cheating you. That's not absolute faith. But if we are able to establish some sort of personal relationship with God, then faith comes in there. You know, I have personal relationship. I don't have faith that God exists. I have reason to believe that God exists. But I have faith in God guiding me through life, and I have faith that God arranged this meeting by divine providence. Because God gave me certain commission like Himself. And I have reason to believe, I have logical reason to believe Him, to have faith. Now, do I know that God is not lying to me right now? I don't have 100% proof, but that's where the new personal relationship with God comes in.
Can I respond to that?
Sure.
I would just like to quickly talk about a point that
Well, how often parents brought up this live reportage, they come into them or a group of people from a certain state. I have a personal relationship with God, I have experience God. And this happens a lot, and it's seemingly convincing, except for when you consider the fact that, and these numbers are just thrown off, but there's 14 million Jews in the world, over 1.5 billion Muslims, over 2 billion Christians, having the same experiences, but attributing it to a different God. Now, they are technically the same God, and it wasn't the same God, but there are differences. That's why Christians aren't Jews, even though they were originally. That's why Muslims are not Jews. They just borrowed it from them. Okay, so you say, done with that point, you say that you have reasons. Now, I heard first cause, I've heard the theological argument, these are all very nice arguments, and they're intuitively convincing, but I have not you have not offered any concrete evidence as to why this first God should be the Jewish God. What qualities does this first cause have to have that the Jewish God has? And what makes you think the Jewish God designed the universe? And as far as first cause is concerned, I would just like to know whether or not you believe in the Big Bang Theory or whether or not there is another first cause for you.
So really key point about just the point that you raised, how do I know that the first cause is the Jewish God? The first cause is the first cause blanket. In other words, he's not Jewish, he's not Jewish, it is the first cause. There are certain properties, there are certain characteristics. One of them, and maybe that is that he has no properties, he has no form, no figure of any type or shape, and in a sense that might disqualify the Christian God. But generally speaking, what we understand is the Jewish God didn't begin it doesn't begin with the first cause, but it begins with, and let's take another step, the definition of, correct me if I'm wrong, but the definition of a Jewish God is the God of the Ten Commandments. The God that, in a sense, is engaged with creation, is engaged with his created beings, and demands from the created beings. And that Jewish God is something that came from, in a sense, through communication, through the mass communication reportage that Alex mentioned earlier. As for exactly how did the universe start at one point with the, yes, exactly how it started, I don't know, could very well have been a big thing, by all means. But the question is, what's the term under the Big Bang? And that's the first clause.
I just want to add, the difference between, I definitely feel you. I mean, all the people are coming around and saying, yeah, I got the information of God, and you know, it's X God, it's Y God, it's Z God. I went to a cave, and I saw an angel with two tablets, golden tablets, and he gave me information. And then they come back and go, well, where's the angel? He left, where's the tablets? So he took them. This is where the idea of master relation comes in. Master relation gives credibility to Judaism, which no other religion has, because it doesn't have that idea. And master relation is a very powerful idea. I mean, it's a very powerful idea that all of your ancestors saw God. And the powerful idea called meme, for example, it's a stable idea, which every religion should have, if it's so easy to invent. But only Judaism has it statistically. And that is the reason why we believe specifically in Jewish God. As far as properties that God has, God doesn't have any properties. God, by definition, as a first cause, cannot have any properties. Because those properties, if something has properties, it must have a source. And by definition, God being the first source, it cannot have properties. However, a propertyless God cannot interact with the universe. Therefore, God creates, so to speak, an interface for interaction with the universe. And that interface already can have properties. And that's where the idea of praying to God, God cannot change. I agree 100%. But an interface created by God can change.
I just need to say that this is a very, very complicated thesis which has been discussed for centuries and millennia. And if I, you know, if a child comes into this room and says, ah, well, gravity, Galileo, all objects fall with the same speed to the ground. But look, the feather flies much slower than the pen. So, you know, yes. But this is because you haven't tried to book physics properly, and you don't know all the other variables. And a lot of questions which Max has asked are absolutely valid, crucial questions, which have been addressed in 12th century by Jews and by philosophers. And then there is a story, and there's a story. There's a story that an atheist once came to a leader of Chabad Hasidus in 19th century, and it gave him a lot of arguments. And I don't believe in your God. And the rabbi said, don't worry, the God you don't believe in, I don't believe in either. And just to address the last question, I don't believe in Big Bang. I know about it.
One last question, and then we'll throw open the discussion to the audience. And that is, both sides here seem to rest their case, especially Alex's case and Max's case, on empirical facts, on the empirical fact of a mass revelation, a unique mass revelation, or the unique reportage of a mass revelation, and the failure, in Max's case, of religious societies and civilizations to distinguish themselves as in any way superior. So I want to ask the philosopher's question about a kind of thought experiment. If we discovered a hitherto unknown group that attested to a mass revelation of a God with different qualities than the God that the Jews worship, would it shake your faith in Judaism? And similarly to Max, if we came across a society that had a distinctive religious theology, that had a Garden of Eden kind of life because of it, would it shape your anti-religious position?
I don't think I can answer that question so easily. I would surely be interested in it. I'm sure somebody would write a book about it, and I would read that book, and I would see exactly what was happening there, because these things happen all the time. If I can just quickly address the mass revelation. If you go to any Pentecostal church across the country, you're going to get the same thing. Everyone feels Christ in them. They talk in tongues. They'll all attest to it. So this is not unique to Judaism. Christianity might have gotten it from Judaism, but it's certainly not unique to Judaism anymore. I would certainly be really interested in the society that Professor Samick presented, but it's not going to shake my faith unless I invest time into understanding what's going on there, trying to understand as much as I possibly can about the facts. If I'm really interested, I might try and go there. If I'm really kind of intrigued by it, if I think, hey, maybe I'm wrong, because I might be wrong. I mean, I'm perfectly fine with being wrong. I just think that we should be a little bit more open about the fact that maybe more than the atheists are wrong, maybe everybody's wrong. Not really sure. I think a lot of our opinions come from, and our sort of anti-religious views come from this sort of superiority. Like, I know for a fact, or I know the evidence that God exists. Well, which God? Okay, well, everybody has their different pieces of evidences. So all these gods can exist. Zarathustra can exist. Can he? With the God of Judaism? With the God of Christianity? Can he? I don't think so. No, that would not shake my faith.
First, test the professor's question. 100% would shake my faith. Yeah. Because if some of the evidence was presented that we're all living in some sort of matrix, and the creator was created by aliens, and we were being sent information about the laws and everything that happens around me, probably shape my faith in the laws of physics too, but in what's the probability of that happening? And I can't just address the point of view of the question of why we're so sure. I'm not sure of anything. I'm not sure Paris is not an alien. I'm not sure either way, right? But I can't live my life every day suspecting that Paris is an alien because there's a remote possibility that happening. I get into my and the taxi driver may be out there to hijack me. But I just need to base my life on probabilities. And science is based on probabilities. There's no experiment you can make whose results will give you 100% probability. You just rely on the probability, on either probability that this is right. By the way, the probability that we usually, the color point is 95%. But it's 95%. There's always 5% probability that something is messed up in your shoulder. But scientists simply rely on time. And we just have to take the evidence, we just take to take what's in front of us. About mass relation in the church, I don't think they claim to see God, to feel God. To really experience knowledge of God. They claim that they experience something which they attribute to God. So I can find a photograph which is written with handwriting. Looks very similar to my grandmother's, Bob and Jane, 1949. And I think that, okay, this is a photograph that's my grandmother, but when I talk on the phone to my grandmother, there's this intuitive and unmistakable feeling of that I'm talking to my grandmother. It's not, there's always a chance that whether it's an imposter. I worry about it sometimes. but I just have to go with the probabilities that it's really my grandmother on the other line, on the end of the line talking to me. And finally, one community can be brainwashed into believing into having some sort of experience. You can give drugs to a lot of people, to hurt people, and they'll have some sort of hallucination at the same time. But it's very, very difficult to convince a nation, at the same time, a whole nation, to believe in something at one time. What can be done is if the whole nation agrees, but that's, again, the conspiracy theories, they never work because it's very difficult for a whole nation to agree at the same time together. And especially it's very difficult for a whole Jewish nation to agree to something together. It's very difficult for two Jews to agree. In the US we have two major parties. Before the State of Israel was formed, there were already 17 parties. So I just don't believe the idea that the Jewish nation had a conspiracy to agree about the last relation passage there.
Thank you. Let's open up the floor to questions from the audience.
I was wondering, you're talking about this idea of the great probability of there being God, and that you believe in the Judaic God because you believe that the probability is so great.
The questioner asked, I think the comment about Jews might have a stronger, unshakable, absolute belief.
I definitely know there are Jews over there. I'd say maybe the majority of Jews are like that. But we are actually commanded by the law to investigate and to know intellectually. Maimonides, one of the codifiers of Jews, realizes that the person has the ability to intellectually and rationally understand the idea of the existence of God. He must take all the steps to do so. Now, do I believe that it's a bad thing that Jews don't take steps, that are Jews that don't take steps to intellectually investigate the existence of God? I think there is. Do I think it's in and of itself it's wrong that they believe in God? I don't think so, because somebody could take a vaccine because he has scientific evidence about the vaccine's function, but somebody could take vaccine because his grandmother convinced him to do it. So second way is definitely not the way to go for a rational person, but I'm happy he took a vaccine. I think that's the question.
Thank you. Another question. Yes?
Share religious beliefs or share foundation groups, and they've never had time.
just people from those groups, you know, they met together and said, hey, are they exactly the same, or they get together, and then you find out they had ulterior motives, like they both wanted to prove the existence of God and they were pretty cool with each other's ideas, and they decided to sort of make up this story. You have to go with what's more likely in this kind of situation, unless I'm given a situation with the historical facts and I can say, okay, these people definitely didn't have any contact at all, and they came to the same conclusion, and that would be very shaking for me. And I would say, okay, this is really interesting. But this kind of stuff happens all the time. A lot of the time it's just peel back the surface a little bit, and they have this in mind, and they wanted to prove what they believe, so they fabricated things. If we could, after this, could we start, could we address some of the points that each other made?
I'd like to give you a little more time, and if there's more time,
okay.
Afterwards, take it outside. Yes.
I just wanted to ask if you believe that someone could be a Jewish atheist, or if you think that's a contradiction, that you can't be a Jew if you don't believe God.
So this is a question about the role belief in God has in being Jewish. Can one be a Jewish atheist?
Do I believe that can be a Jewish atheist?
Apparently, yes.
Surprisingly enough. No, I think that you're asking me, like, it's sort of a question, like, can you be a Christian atheist? Can you, it depends on what your definition of a Jew is. In Judaism, the definition of a Jew is not something which is your choice, unless you convert. It's something, it's sort of like being, human being, sort of like having a liver. You know, if whether you believe you have a liver or not, you have a liver. So in that terms, yeah, there can be atheists for still Jews who have what's called Jewish soul, and yeah, they're atheists. But if your definition of a Jew is somebody who believes in Judaism, then obviously being an atheist and believing in Judaism is a bit contradictory.
Maybe I can sharpen that question by. I was told recently of a study of Jewish women who lit candles before the beginning of the Sabbath, and they were asked why they light candles. And the answers range from, because my mother did, because it wouldn't be Shabbos if I didn't, because it holds my family together. Almost none of them mentioned God or the commandment to light candles. So I'm wondering, how central do you think a definite view on the existence of God is to religious life?
To religious conduct or to religious theology? To religious life, you can definitely live a religious life, and that's something that Alex mentioned earlier, that you can definitely live a religious life without taking the time to investigate God and thinking about God and having God a part of your identity. You could even be praying 3 times a day and be the most observant, scrupulous Jew, but doing it completely out of routine. And God doesn't play a role in it, and that is certainly not something that's looked upon positively in the overall, but like Al said earlier, you are taking the vaccine to some degree. To some degree, you're not. But bottom line, you can't be practicing or being a practicing Jew without being aware of God, and this is very often the case that way, but it's definitely not a problem.
Yes?
There are certain buildings associated with each belief that Dominicans or atheists and they're Christians.
Could you start your question again, please?
There are certain buildings associated with every mindset. Did you say Stalin for
atheists?
And Hitler for Christians?
Hey, Christians villainize Hitler, or Hitler for everything that Christians
villainize? Okay, well, anyway, stop the question. Would you use this villain in defense of your belief set, or would you not? And if not, why not?
This question is for us.
I guess so.
Okay.
I think a lot of the way argument traditionally goes about the role of morality in Judaism, between the atheist and atheist. The atheist says, well, all atheists are immoral and evil, and you cannot have morality without atheism. And the atheist says, look how many people were killed by crusaders, by jihadists, etc., etc. And that atheist says, well, what about Hitler and Stalin? They killed even more. And then the atheist says, yeah, but those were just religions. Those were just as religion, as attached religions, as Christianity or Judaism or something, blah, 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 blah. And I agree with the atheist. When you use faith as a basis for your conduct, bad things happen. 100%. When you delegate your intellectual ability to make choice to something else, to some, you know, to some person, to government, to organization, to whatever, to grandmother, bad things can happen. Well, probably not so much in the last case. But I agree that that's why we think that Judaism is unique as far as religions go. In fact, it's sort of almost a misnomer to call it religion, because they don't call everything else religion. It's not based on faith. I've heard one rabbi once say, to great dismay of his host, that he doesn't believe in God, he doesn't believe in Torah, he doesn't believe in prophets. He knows about them. And this is the difference between Judaism and all the other religions, and this is how your conduct should be in all areas of your life, 100%.
The question really is, what is the relationship between morality and belief in God, and to what extent can revelation possibly trump or override our inherent moral feelings? What if an angel said, came down and said, it's okay to murder your grandmother? Would that make it right? Is that, and the answer is?
I would tell that angel to shut up. What has been established once at that point of departure, that point of beginning at Mount Sinai, when there was this communication between God and the Jewish people, and most notably the Ten Commandments, remains eternal and can never be changed in any way, shape, or form. As far as people who don't believe in the Ten Commandments, or don't believe in the idea of God instituting a sense of morality, sure, and I said that earlier. There are people that do good things and many, 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 many good things and are moral people and don't believe in God. That's definitely possible. The question is, and what is the motivation? And the test is when that motivation is challenged. And when it's based on a certain calculation of social stability, and eventually social stability that will affect me if I don't participate in social stability. Well, that's a calculation that you can make, but that's a calculation that sometimes can be ignored. When you personally are, you know, you need right now the money, otherwise something, you're not going to have the car that you want, or someone will affect your comfort. Or when you feel your comfort being in danger. So then you will reevaluate the calculation. Now that's not to say that people that believe in God are always acting morally. People who believe in God will act immorally. And that is considered the greatest sin. Somebody who believes in God and acts immorally is desecrating the name of God, and that's perhaps one of the only sins that is unforgivable.
But we're not speaking. We're trying to speak objectively. Objectively comparing the two reasons for morality. The one for believing God is one that is absolute, and that is also one that can motivate you to morality. Because the belief in God basically takes you from the egocentric to the allocentric. It takes you from the being narcissistic to being altruistic, taking the center of your identity or your existence from yourself and placing it in another being that equally justifies your existence as it does your neighbor or anybody around you.
I just have a quick question. You speak of fixated morality and how it, because even if time has progressed, moral claims in the Bible aren't altered. Wouldn't it be exceedingly easy to just eliminate one line in Leviticus or one line in Deuteronomy and make the ethical theory in the Bible extraordinarily much better? If you eliminate stoning your slaves or your wife, isn't that more congruent with ethical theory in modern times?
It depends on your definition of ethics and morality. If your definition of ethics and morality a priori is something which comes from an absolute source, and God cannot say that God obeys the laws of morality. The laws of morality exist somewhere out there, and there is not here based on God, because we've got the definition of the first source. And therefore, you cannot use modern views about your ethics and morality. And say, in other words, by definition, what comes from God is ethical and moral. If your definition of ethics and morality is, for lack of a better word, is atheistic, in other words, it's a value of morality, not absolute, then what that means is what is moral is what creates the best stability in the society. So, in that sense, slavery is not moral in Roman societies, because the Roman Empire could not have developed that slavery. As shocking as it sounds to us, it is not, and that's what Peretz talks about, by the way. You know, giving away to a guest is not moral in some societies which are isolated from outside culture, because it improves the gene pool. A lot of things that would seem shocking to us living in Western society, based on Judeo-Christian morals, are not immoral by definition of atheist morality, because it will lead to greater stability of society.
So just to clarify, the Virginia Tech shooter who received exorcism after exorcism to try to eliminate the devils with him, that is more moral than going to see a psychiatrist?
No, because morality must be, if you say that morality is based on an absolute source, then you need rational reason to believe in the absolute source. And that's where, again, that's where the whole system comes in.
All the way at the back.
I'm not sure where it is. There's a law saying and stating you shall not suffer the witch to live. So is killing witches moral in that sense? And if, as most people would agree, there aren't any witches around, is this because of the effectiveness of the Inquisition or simply because they never were? And if so, the latter, how did it come from the Bible in the first place?
Here's a question about witches. The Bible is very strict in commanding the Israelites to take their land, not to allow witches to survive. So the question is multi-pronged. Is it the success of that biblical injunction that explains why they're not infested with witches? That's one part. Another part is, are there really witches? And if there aren't, what exactly is the role? The role of that injunction in the Bible, and I didn't quite get the third prong, but maybe that's enough for now.
I think you're using the definition of witch from Western popular culture, inspired by Christianity, and you're confusing it with the definition of witch which exists in Judaism. And as to whether there are witches, you think that killing witches is like, finding a red haired woman who makes chicken soup and just saying she's a witch and killing her.
That's not the definition that, that Judaism has. And Judaism does not rely on Bible for laws. Judaism relies on oral tradition, which contextual oral tradition, right now written down in the book called Talmud, which accompanied Bible. And there are cases, in other words, you have to look at the context. You cannot just throw a word out of there and hear the same words in there. No, as to whether the witches exist today, unfortunately, I don't know.
Yes. You were just right.
All right, Alex, if you say that it's only highly probable that there's a God, why don't you consider yourself an agnostic? And similarly, I forgot who said it in Acts or Jonah. If you say that you believe in God, the right evidence just hasn't come along, why don't you guys consider yourself agnostics?
Well, agnostic means, a lot of people seem to be confused about what agnostic is. An agnostic is not somebody who is unsure. An agnostic is somebody who doesn't know. And as I said, all knowledge is probabilistic. In other words, my knowledge about laws of physics is probabilistic. My knowledge about laws of Newton is probabilistic. Anything. My knowledge that this world exists is probabilistic. Therefore, when we say the word no, we don't mean 100% sure and there's no way to be otherwise. It's saying it's most probable. As far as agnostic, there are theoretical agnostics, but there are no practical agnostics. Practically, a person is either an atheist or a theist. And I'll give you an example. Somebody tells me, this Coke is poison, right? So I can be an atheist. For sure, this Coke is not poison. I have evidence. I can be agnostic. I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Or I can be a theist. Yeah, this Coke is poison. But so, from a theoretical point of view, there are three positions. Yes, no, maybe. But when I take a sip, or I don't take a sip, I'm either an atheist, practically, or a theist. Therefore, my academic knowledge, my academic question of am I sure about God's existence, am I not sure about God's existence, it's academic. But what matters is what do I practice? Do I practice it as if I believe for sure that God exists, or do I not practice, and therefore it is as if I was sure that God doesn't exist?
We use the same logic. In fact, no, I do. I think the best way to think about it is the sliding scale. Richard Dawkins says this is 1 to 7. 1, absolutely sure that there is, 7, that there isn't. I'm a 6, maybe. I operate as an atheist, but I operate that I don't believe in theories too.
So if you're a 6, you're an agnostic.
I am an agnostic, yes, but I operate, it's a side of the darkness, so I say an atheist, taking that point across. If I say agnostic, it's it gets worse.
Just to clarify, as theists, do you believe in all the supernatural miracles that have been mentioned in the Bible, in the Old Testament? Clearly, right?
This is the setup of the question. First, do they believe that the theists accept all the miracles that are recorded in the Bible?
Supernatural miracles, like such as the splitting of the Red Sea, for example.
If that's my point of departure, and I begin by believing that the world was created by God from nothing, coming this fascinating world, believing that a couple of supernatural miracles occurred is a lot easier.
Well,
so,
yes,
they
do.
This is my question. The question is, if you do believe in the past, whether this is clearly like in the past, probably like 2,000, 3,000 years ago, how would you explain the lack of supernatural miracles in today's world? Do you think God retired? What would you say?
How can theists explain the sudden drop of miracles in our world from biblical times to
To go back to Maimonides comments on this and says that miracles, in fact, this world was not created for the sake of miracles. This world, there is a reason why this world is like this, and God is here in the world. There's a purpose for it. There isn't miracles happened only when there was absolute need for it. You know, for Jews to know that God exists and to receive Torah, the set of laws, and to be a miracle. And then Maimonides goes to each miracle and says, "Oh, there was necessity for it to happen." There was Egyptians running after them. They come to Red Sea. was it good to split the sea for Jews to go through, etc. Every miracle had a reason to happen. But somebody could argue that overall, existence of Jews as a nation, the fact that they're Jews today, seeing that there are an argument that God exists, is a miracle in itself. Because no other culture, no other nation has existed, has survived the conditions. Jews, if you look at Jewish history, Jews have had their own state. And it was a really powerful state in the region. Then they lost the state, they were sent to slavery. Then again they got the state, which was sometimes independent, sometimes dependent. Then they were again sent to exile. Then they were persecuted, there were expulsions, there were pogroms, there were economic hardships. And yet, Jews did not assimilate, and Jews today exist. That overall can be said to be a miracle. But this is just sort of a caveat. But to answer your question more directly, there was just no need for it necessarily.
I just want to add one more point, and that is the reason why there is no need for miracles, and the purpose of the way God fails, or the way the purpose of God interacts with the world is with as minimal miracle as possible, because the purpose of creation is for human beings, as they are human beings, with their frailties, to make decisions, and to make the right decisions as a result of their personal awareness of the difference of what's right and what's wrong, and in a sense, making life better for themselves or making life better as a whole. So the fact that the world does not look like the Garden of Eden of God, an old, wonderful, super-duper God, is actually an indication that this God created this world in a sense, in a way that human beings have a moral responsibility and have an objective to, in a sense, be divine life. And the ability to make right choices and make wrong choices. More often than not in the past, they've made wrong choices, but many times they've made right choices, and the goal is to progressively move forward with making of the right choices.
Can I respond to that? No.
Sure.
Sure. Just in direct response to the Red Sea parting in the Bible, it's not the Red Sea, it's the Sea of Reeds. Unlike the Hebrew, but it's Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds. So there was no parting in the Red Sea. I think the Sea of Reeds is a little stream or something that they looked across. There's also very, very little archaeological evidence that Jews were ever enslaved by the Egyptians, and almost none, I believe there's actually none, that they wandered in the desert for 40 years. So believing this kind of stuff is purely unsafe. Is that something there's reason to believe it, other than the fact that somebody wrote it down, several people wrote it down? It's a nice tradition. As a tradition, it's wonderful. As a fairy tale, it's wonderful. But as a source of how you operate in your life, as a source of how you form your beliefs, it is absolutely useless. I just want to one thing that Herod said, which is very revealing. He said, from nothing comes nothing. Where does God come from? From nothing comes nothing, where does God come from? What happened to faith is what I said earlier, is that the faith will take reason up to the point where they don't need it anymore. So they say there has to be a first cause. Everything needs a cause. Well, then God needs a cause. No, God doesn't need a cause. No. That's when you have faith. So you can have reason up to the point where it doesn't prove your point anymore, and then you just stick faith in there. It's called a godly gap argument. Where does gap? Just put God in there. Same with the theological argument for design. Who designed this? I don't know. God.
So the lack of history teaches us that I was once yelled at by a history professor during an essay claiming that Vikings did not travel along Volga route, river route to get to Arab countries because there were no burials of coins along the route, just along the Dnieper River. And he said, lack of archaeological evidence doesn't mean anything. It's not, the history in general as we practice it is not based on archaeological evidence. It's a misconception. Archaeological evidence helps us and provides additional evidence, but for the most part, especially ancient history, which this relation of Sinai belongs to, just by historical period is concerned, we rely on literary evidence. You cannot imagine how many things there are that rely on literary evidence, because we don't have any reason to believe it. And there are also many,
most definitely may be reasons why there's no archaeological evidence in Egypt of flags and of the slavery. Unfortunately, I'm not an expert in Egyptology. But why there are no archaeological evidence in the desert? I mean, first of all, what kind of archaeological evidence do they want? The Jews wandering around the desert, sitting in booths in tents made of sticks. Okay, so what do you want? And second, our tradition tells us that in fact, miraculously, there was no archaeological, there were no remains left of clothes and pottery, etc. So if there were archaeological evidence, that would be more a problem to me than there is. And as far as God, there's nothing from nothing, so where is God coming from? Well, what makes you think that God is something? And happened. God is not something, nor is God nothing. God is something else. God is not something which you can define, into which you can give definition called something. Some people in Jewish theology would say we cannot say that God exists, because existence means that they're not atheists, before you start saying that they're. Existence means having a particular definition, having particular properties. Being in space and time, that's what something existing means. And that's a problem. Of course, if you believe God is some force, some defined force, and you know, some grandfather sitting on a cloud, or some something particular which then organizes the world, then yeah, it's nonsense. It's logically impossible. In Judaism, it's much more sophisticated, but these topics are studied by people for a long time, and these are, you know, topics which are no less complex, theological. Topics are no less complex than a lot of modern ideas in physics. So you just have to sit down and learn what does it mean that God is not something, but God is not nothing. What does it mean that God doesn't change, but interact with the world? All these ideas, I promise you, exist in Judaism. None of them are answered in a rational, logical way.
You?
So I have two questions for the theists. The first one is you spoke about sort of the idea of higher morality, that where God comes in is where altruism comes in and egoism is left behind. I'm not Jewish, but from what I understand, I would be confronted with, obviously, I know your argument is that I couldn't be confronted with God because he's not a physical thing, but he seems to do a lot of things that scare me, the smiting, like the... my question is, like with classical conditioning in mind and all of the ideas behind psychology, weekly revisiting of the things written in the Bible and the idea that God is in fact almighty, would that not condition people to, like, would it not condition people to think that it isn't no one watching, it's God watching and God almighty? And then my second question is, you sort of set up sort of an equation. Basically, God can exist on the same principles that the flying pen and the double slit experiment both can succeed. We couldn't have known about it beforehand. And that what makes the leap from not knowing it beforehand to believing it is the large group of people who have retold the story and who believe it and have survived for all these years. But basically, what you had said was the nation, the idea that you can convince a nation of people, not just a couple of people. And so my question for you is, I'm very familiar with the idea of the Virgin of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which is much more than just a nation who follows it, but an entire continent, and then a whole bunch more. Do you then, since it follows the same logic, believe the Virgin of Guadalupe Hidalgo?
So the question I took part, the first part was, could it be that religious belief is a matter of conditioning? And the alternated stories read from the Torah. The second is about the Virgin of Hidalgo.
The second is just offering a comparable example. I think
that you think is a mass illusion of some sort.
That follows the same logical ground.
So you think that is not a unique national revelation?
Yes, and so I was wondering if that was why that would hold the same water.
The first question was, can Judaism be conditioned?
Can the explanation of Jewish belief be just simply a propaganda campaign?
Particularly, not necessarily propaganda.
I mean,
you mean believe in mass revelation?
I'm sorry?
Believe in mass revelation at Sinai.
Not the belief in mass revelation, but you brought up the idea of
morality. Well, of course it can be. Yeah, I mean, there are,
sure,
100%. You can have a idea of morality coming out of social evolution.
Sure,
it happens all the time in all other societies. But in other words, when you're saying that these laws originated through social evolution, you're just ripping them out of the context of the story of how these laws came to us.
I
say that this story could not have come about by social evolution, because that's just so improbable.
That wasn't so much my question. My question is more the idea that the idea of fear of a god and how that shaped morality and the difference between egoistic morality and altruistic morality. Pascal, in response to fear of a god.
Pascal, the wager. Is that what you're referring?
I'm not sure. I just know like lots of things like. Well, the Jewish God can destroy
us, how are we? Yes, you know, fear or awe of God does play a major role in the morality equation.
But it's more fear. You know, I'm afraid to hit a child on the street, therefore I slow down. That's not fear. It's a fear of consequences. It's a fear of doing something universal or wrong. That's not the fear that the big angry God will come and punish me. That's more the realm of other two Abrahamic religions. As far as the miracle, I'm afraid to disappoint you, but in my experience of dealing with the last argument, the argument of it's called Khuzari argument, the argument of masculation tradition, etc. People come up and present, like, oh, what about the Indians? Or what about that? What about this? And present examples. And if you start looking down more carefully into this example, it turns out that something is wrong, that one of the elements is missing. Iliad, that said that God was flying above the battlefield, and isn't that masculine, etc. But if you look, if you sit down and carefully read line by line, and figure out it just doesn't fit exactly. But it's just that's one example which I have not encountered in my experience. But so I'm sorry.
Yeah, I would like to hear your reasons why it just doesn't fit, because when I look at the Greek gods, I see very, very similar things. They have human flaws. They get jealous. They get angry. How can something, well, God is not something, he is something that which we don't know. How can he get angry? How did he get angry? How did he start before? Why did he start before? I mean, how does he do that? He's nothing. No, he's not nothing. He's not something. He's just that which we don't know. But he gets angry and he talks to Moses, and Moses sees his face. And he comes down and his face is all blown or something like that. And how does that happen with something that is not nothing? Not something?
Next, I got the same questions. The same questions you're asking, I have the exact same question. Okay?
But you're making the claim.
But I am taking the time and the effort to understand those things, what they mean, and they certainly do not mean literally. I'll acknowledge that. The God getting angry and puffing is certainly not literally. Nobody claims that within the Jewish understanding of those verses to be literally in any way, shape, or form. Anybody that does is off the charts. How do we understand that? That is not an issue for another time. But certainly, I'll guarantee you this, it is certainly not literally, in no way.
There's a whole book written by Maimonides, I believe, in the 13th century. The 13th century, in which he goes through all the terms and explains how, what does it mean that there is creation and what does it mean God getting angry. It's pretty much a big vocabulary book. The questions you're asking are the questions that Greek philosophers and Jews who studied Greek philosophy were asking approximately 1,000 years ago. It's like, you know, don't open the physics book in chapter 1 and say you have problems. Read at least until chapter 8. That's just what all I'm saying. Theology, a lot of people don't understand. I don't see a lot of people arguing about nuclear physics. Because they know they need some time to take the more math, learn vocabulary, learn about the idea. But a lot of people seem to have an opinion about evolutionary biology, about economics, about politics, about theology. And those things are not very simple. I mean, those things, some of those things require knowledge of facts, requires discipline. And from the outside, a lot of ideas in, you know, evolutionary biology seem to be absolutely stupid. But you just need to take time to study the facts. And from about economics and about politics in the same way. And all these questions have been asked in the religion, and there are answers.
I think the point was made earlier, I think, by the humanists, that because there's, what I gather is because there's been so many gods over the course of human history, and that they're repeatedly going down, that might delegitimize specific gods. What I think is really amazing is that when all these gods have been torn down, the idea of God has stuck around. And I was just
I want to hear a question.
I don't find it surprising that the idea of God has stuck around. As the question was asked over there, why do humans need this? It's a source of understanding. It's a source of why things make sense. It's a source of an explanation of who we are and where we're going. Humans are innately fearful. And to appeal to something that's out of our control is an extraordinarily appealing notion.
Maybe I'll ask a question. A strange question for a philosopher to ask. It seems that both sides in our debate are champions of reason.
Why surprise?
Because usually the debates over the existence of God pit faith against reason, pit philosophy against theology. But here we have two champions of reason. So let me be the enemy of reason for a minute, and ask whether this belief that reason can give us the ultimate shape of our life and our the way we live, our source of meaning, can all be derived from reason. Isn't that itself a kind of supernatural belief? Is there any argument to prove it? And wouldn't any argument to prove it be circular? I draw this essentially from a tradition in philosophy that's probably most vividly represented by Hume, the 18th century British philosopher, but we don't know that reason is powerful enough to discover the truth about the existence of God. How can we be sure that it will lead us right?
I guess it's a question for us.
And the question for us, because they'll also say, well, reason, yeah, okay, but so much of your life is not based on reason.
You're all familiar with Abraham. Heard of him? Abraham had son Isaac. Isaac was married to Sarah. You'd be surprised if I told you that he was not a Jew. He was not Jewish. And the reason for that was because, as Jews, our awareness of God and our certainty of God and our investigation of God begins with a certain event, and this is an event that we've spoken about before, is the revelation. So the point of departure is a certain awareness, a certain seeing, a certain experience, an experience that we then, from ever since then, have been pursuing to understand, pursuing to rationalize, pursuing to make sense of. Abraham started with rational and with reason, and that's how he began the metaphysical faith, but he was lacking something very strong. And that is revelation, that is the idea of experience or exposure. Our reason and rationale doesn't go circular, it has a point of departure where it leaves from, and where it certainly always returns to in investigating and trying to make sense of and understand.
I just want to say, address that, yeah, reason isn't everything, but we ain't got nothing else. You know, all our actions, every day, determined by reason. You know, we are reason. Cogito ergo sum. What else are we supposed to use to determine? I mean, if I use reason,
heart
can tell you whether to choose salad or hamburger in the restaurant. Heart cannot tell you something objective. Heart can tell you what you want. Heart cannot tell you something that is. Heart cannot tell you whether the moon is made out of blue cheese or rock. Now, I like blue cheese. I don't know really. I do, but that mean that the world is made of blue cheese? That doesn't follow. Now, if I go to a restaurant and I take blue cheese instead of whatever else, then yeah, that's absolutely fine. But that's where heart is supposed to be. If I meet a person and I fall in love, that's where heart is supposed to be. And if I look somebody, if I'm a judge and I look at the person and try to determine if he's guilty or not, but I really like this guy or a gal, that's where love comes from. So that's where heart comes from.
A few things. I don't think we've ever made a claim that rationality is everything. One cannot prove mathematics with mathematics. But you can prove mathematics with a different axiom. You can use logic through mathematics. But just because it's infinitely aggressive doesn't mean to say that I don't know, and then to go from there to faith is weak of logic. Because if it can't be X, it must be Y. We use reasoning in every one of our discourses. And to say it might not be the best, but it's all we have right now. And we're very willing to admit that we don't know.
Thanks. Let's thank Alan.